Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Cut Through Vine for May 10th, a happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there. And welcome, Catherine, and welcome, Tim.
Thank you.
Good evening.
Yes. Well, come give me a spring day, and something about Mother's Day, maybe it made things a little less political, at least in the state of Georgia, because it seems like there was a little less news this week, but obviously enough to talk about, and we're going to get to that. We're on the week before, or less than a week before, the George Jefferson Jackson Day dinner, and Mark Matheny, communications director, is going to come on in a few minutes and talk about that. And in the second half hour, Demetric Biggs, who has worked both for the Mississippi and Georgia Democratic parties, is going to talk to us about the Jackson mayor's race. So we'll have both of those topics, as well as a whole bunch of other news. But, you know, we've talked in the past about John Oxendine's campaign, and we've talked about the role of the AJC and can they do investigative work. And the two things came together this weekend. There was an expose piece about John Oxendine and his campaign contributions. Catherine and Tim, did y'all see that piece?
I did.
Yes. So, Catherine, what was your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, it's not a big surprise. You know, the basis of it is that a bunch of insurance companies contributed money to PACs. It looks like the PACs were in Alabama,
mm-hmm.
and then the money was contributed to Mr. Oxendine's campaign. It's not clear to me that it was legal. It sounds like it was illegal to me, because I understand that candidates are not permitted to accept contributions from companies and industries which they regulate, and it's clear. It sounds clear from the AJC article that these were insurance companies making these contributions. So it's not good. Of course, it's a little late now because he's running for governor now. So,
well, it's a little late, I guess. In some ways, you could say nail him for this in a criminal way, but then it's certainly not late for the voters to nail him. Tim, what's your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, David, it's not the first time we've seen the name of Dee Yancey associated with, you know, fundraising, being that you and I are from the Rome area, and the mutual insurance. This seems to be all going back to that building. A lot of politicians of both parties over the years have held fundraisers at the State Mutual Building. I went to one for Roy Barnes some years ago myself. Even if the law was, shall we say, technically followed, we have people giving money to somebody who regulates them. And,
yeah.
And then there's the, let me hit the political angle a little bit. I just have to wonder which concerned citizen pointed this particular thing out to the AJC. I don't think they stumbled across it. I think somebody put them on to it. Of course, I'm sure nobody in another campaign or a certain governor's office would have done that. Right?
Well, or I thought you were going a different direction, being that there's some Rome ties. You know, the number one government watchdog in the South, George Anderson. I thought you were going that direction.
And interestingly enough, the AJC did not even mention a source, did not even indicate that they had an outside source. And with that, I believe our first caller is on with us.
Martin, welcome.
Hey, how are you guys?
Oh, doing good. Well, Martin, I tell you what. Catherine and Tim, just the usuals here. Let me ask, we're talking about this John Oxendine story with him and the contributions from a strange source. Given that you're the communications director, you might have looked at this a little bit. Martin, what's your take on it?
You know, if it looks like a duck and it walks like a duck, then chances are it's a bad story for John Oxendine.
Yeah, I mean, we know, you know, John Oxendine has been accused and many times of being a flack for the insurance industry. So are we really that surprised?
I'm not really that surprised.
Yes, and I guess we can handle the political ramifications after this in a little while. But we had you to come on to talk to us about this week's Jefferson Jackson Day dinner. First, give us the details, just in case somebody's missed them.
Okay, well, it's Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, a couple days away. I'm sure our finance staff is pulling their hair out right now. It's going to be at the Hyatt Regency in Atlanta, and if you've been to past JJ dinners, and I know you guys have, this is a location change this year. So we're over at the Hyatt Regency on Peachtree in Atlanta, and you can find all the location details and a map on our website at georgiademocrat.org. And the reception kicks off at 5:30, dinner at 6:30. And I wish I could tell you to go buy tickets, but we're sold out. So we've filled our room, and the fire marshal just won't let us put any more folks in there.
Yeah, well, kind of tell us about that. I mean, how did that go about happening? How many does this room hold? What does that mean fundraising-wise? It sounds like good news, but tell us.
Well, it is good news. And what it shows is that, you know, fundraising is tough for a couple of reasons, and I don't have to tell y'all. First of all, it's an off year, and we've been kind of making the point that, you know, these odd-numbered years, 2009 is just as important, maybe more important for Georgia Democrats than 2008 was, because we can't wait till next year to build our infrastructure and have it on the ground and be equipped and trained and ready to go, because, I mean, that's got to be ready to go at the beginning of 2010. So this is such an important building year for us. I think folks are responding to that message. And, you know, it's a tough economy to raise money in, so I'm really just as proud as I can be of Jane and our fundraising team. I think we're going to end up having about 1,500 people in the room, maybe a few more if the fire marshal looks the other way. And it should be a really good event. You know, we started a couple of JJ traditions in the past few years. Last year we started the Georgia Giants Awards and honored Max Cleland and John Lewis. And this year the honorees are going to be Shirley Franklin and Governor Carl Sanders, which I think that's great, because you really don't hear a lot about the effect that Governor Sanders had on the state of Georgia, but it really was tremendous. And of course, we see every day what kind of effect Mayor Franklin's had on the city of Atlanta and how far she's taken the city since she was elected. So, two really really great awards to hand out, and then we've got our keynote speech from Governor Phil Bredesen of Tennessee, two-term Democratic governor, and a really good reminder as we go into a gubernatorial year here in Georgia. We can absolutely elect a Democratic governor, you know, here in the South.
Yes, is he in the leadership of the DGA?
You know, I'm not sure. I know he's an extremely popular and well-respected governor. And, in fact, when he was first elected, here's my fun Phil Bredesen fact for the day. When he was first elected back in 2002, we were in an economic crisis nationally. And he was able to pass four balanced budgets without raising taxes and without cutting education. So I really kind of would like to invite Governor Perdue to come to the dinner, and maybe he could find out how we do that, you know, because clearly he hasn't learned that lesson.
Yes. Well, I want to pass this thing around. Catherine, any questions for Martin on the dinner or anything else going on?
Well, hey, Martin, this is great news, because I know a lot of people who couldn't afford the tickets for the JJ dinner this year, so I'm glad that there were people out there who could.
Mm-hmm.
And
a lot of credit, by the way, goes to our county parties, because they were really out there hustling tickets. So we're going to have our counties well represented.
Well, unfortunately, I won't be able to go, but, you know, I'm sure you'll have a good time without me. But I 100% agree with you that, you know, the off years are the years that we need to build the party and put the infrastructure together. And I'm just wondering what, aside from, you know, fundraising with the JJ dinner, what's going on with that in that regard right now?
Well, you know, kind of the centerpiece of what we're doing for party building is going to be the Georgia Democrats Work Program. And that's our partnership with Jason Carter's group, Democrats Work. And that's going to be actually going statewide pretty soon after JJ. You know, even before he was inaugurated, the president kind of came out with this big call to service for America, and we've taken that on. So we're trying to show folks that, you know, the Democratic Party of Georgia is there when we need you to vote, but we're there trying to make our communities better as well. So we've done, I believe, 4 projects in Atlanta that have been really successful kind of pilot projects for the program, and we're going to be taking it statewide soon.
Great.
So that's going to be kind of the centerpiece. It's a way to bring in, you know, not just the kind of the folks who make up the meat and bones of our party now, but to bring in some new folks as well who, you know, want to help out in their communities, and it'll increase our it'll increase our grassroots presence and hopefully bring in some new volunteers for us.
Great. That's good. Go ahead. I don't have anything more, Tim. Go ahead.
Martin, I was wondering about the venue itself. What went into the thinking of choosing this particular venue this year?
Well, you know, we've had actually this is my third JJ at the party, and this is our first JJ since, I guess, 2006, where we haven't had a presidential candidate. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, we had John Edwards came in 2007, and of course we had Senator Clinton back in last year. So we wanted something that was, you know, we've got the governor's race coming up in 2010, something that was a little more intimate and a little more focused on Georgia. Last year was about kind of establishing Georgia on the national stage. Remember, it was, I think, 6 days before before Georgia's presidential primary. And, this is something that's going to be a little bit more focused on Georgia and the opportunities that we have here with all the statewide elections coming up on 2010. And, you know, the Hyatt is a great venue for that. It's a beautiful room. And, also just kind of nice to switch it up. We've done World Congress Center, I know, for the last 2 years, and I believe for a year or so before that. So, yeah, just kind of nice to switch it up a little bit and show off a little. So I think it's going to be a great room.
Okay, and somebody wanted me to ask you this question, and I didn't know the answer to it myself, and maybe you don't, but the question is this. The Russell dinner is always on a weekend, and the JJ dinner is always on a weekday. Is that by design? Why is that?
Well, I don't think it's by design, if you mean sort of by coordination between us and the GADCC. You know, a lot of times it works out, and yeah, the JJ dinner for us is a fundraising event, and it costs us a little bit of money to put on, but, you know, and we want to try to maximize the return we're getting so that we're not spending, you know, as much, you know, spending a whole lot of the money that we're raising on putting on the dinner. We want it to be nice. We want it to be elegant, but we also want to make sure we've got money for, you know, things like phone banks. So a lot of times you get a better rate on a room during the week as well. And a lot of times it's just availability too, you know. Especially when you're dealing with Atlanta venues that are big enough to hold a Democratic Party of Georgia Jefferson Jackson dinner, sometimes you've got to be a little bit more flexible on your date. So we're talking about, you know, convention stuff that's booked 2 years in advance sometimes. So a lot of times it's calling around to see what's available, you know, 6 months down the road, and, hey, we've got a Tuesday in May. Sounds good. Let's do it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The third factor that goes into that is keynote speaker scheduling too. So we got a lot of balls to juggle, so.
Yeah, been there, done that, buddy, let me tell you. David?
Yes, well, I mean, we're just excited that the party has been able to, you know, it sounds like you had a specific plan for this off-year bad economy fundraising effort, and you met it. I mean, and that's a huge thing to do because obviously people go in and the room's full, everybody's energized. I mean, you have some real notable folks, so I think it's an outstanding effort that everybody should be proud of.
Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be a great time. You know, I love doing these things, and I think everybody usually has a good time, you know, within the controlled chaos that Democratic Party events always are. And we're going to try to put on a good show for you.
Yeah, and so and obviously, you know, we're so far out. You were mentioning presidential candidates. I don't think people realize that a lot of times. I remember one year John Kerry was not the keynote speaker and came down and asked for 10-minute speech, and you could tell this was back. Tim, I believe you were there. This was like 98 or something. I mean, this was, you know,
long-term
planning.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering if, you know, people may be surprised at who comes out, because a lot of times folks that have – they're on some office start making the rounds early just to get ahead of the curve. So.
And, you know, with the work that we did on the JJ last year and kind of establishing Georgia as being a player in this huge crop of February 5th states, and, of course, we're going to need to see what happens with primary scheduling going into 2012, and with an incumbent Democratic president, that puts a different twist on it too. But, yeah, I think that you will see Georgia taking a little bit more preeminence on the national stage, you know, looking a few years down the road.
Yes. Well, Martin, since we got you on here, anything non-JJ related that you need to share with us, or has it kind of been a slow time since the session's over?
Well, you know, I can kind of tell you a little bit about what we're doing over at the party. And after Tuesday, and in fact, a lot of this work is going on already, the big push moves over to Georgia Democrats Work Program that I was talking about that's going to go statewide, and you can find out a little bit more on that on the website. You know, and along with that, you know, from my end, we're going to be continuing to work over the pretty much over the next 6 to 8 months, right up to the beginning of the year, if not a little after, trying to start putting together some messaging for 2010, figure out what we want to talk about, and looking at targeted candidates that we want to make sure on the Georgia General Assembly level that we've got some folks running against. So, you know, this is really going back to what I said before. 2009 is when it's not the most sexy time in politics, but it's really where the rubber meets the road. It's where you do the stuff that makes you look good in 2010.
Well, certainly. Well, best of luck on this, and of course, you're welcome to join us anytime, but thanks for bringing the info.
Guys, I appreciate it.
Thanks, Martin.
Thanks, Martin.
Thank you all.
Yes, and of course, that night, I've got game on, and that's one of my you know, responsibilities for being part of Blog Talk Radio and the Heading Left Net channel, which is actually, I think people may have started to hear this, it's actually going to not be in existence within about a week or two. About mid-May, they're going to take that thing down after Heading Left and Heading Right. But I got to be there for one of the final shows to actually be on Heading Left. But I want to hear about it because, like I said, I think there's a lot of things that go into these dinners that are important to the political life of a state.
Are you going, Tim?
No, ma'am, I'm not. It's through the week, and when you have to get up at 4 a.m.
Oh, I know. It's hard when it's on a weeknight. Even here in Atlanta, it's hard for us when it's on a weeknight, but we couldn't go anyway.
That's why I've only made it to a couple of them.
I tell you what's funny. I bet between the three of us, we've missed probably one or zero in the last few years, but this is just one of those years, it sounds like, for all of us. It's kind of unusual, but it sounds like I'm glad that, you know, they've got 1,500 other good Democrats, maybe 700.
Yeah, that's great. I'm really glad to hear that.
Yes.
Weren't y'all a little surprised in this off year that they were able to sell the venue out like that?
I think it shows that this is real party strength. I mean, this is not, you know, they're fair weather fans for sports teams. This is not fair weather people that just want to come out because their presidential candidate is going to be there or to support their presidential candidate. These are people that really are long-term supporters then through the county parties, and that sounds like a stronger base to have. But still, it was a surprise. Well, I guess getting back to our discussion about John Oxendine, now we talked about maybe some of the legal ramifications, but what about the political ramifications? I can't imagine that this is good news for him, seeing as that now he has Nathan Deal in the primary, Karen Handel still trying to, you know, make inroads, and you got Eric Johnson. You already had a full slate. I mean, he was ahead, and that was, you know, kind of surprising to at least me. But then to have to fight off this kind of allegation with such a full field of contenders in the primary, I just don't see how this does him any good. Tim, what do you think?
Absolutely not. And I know I kind of hinted around that some things while ago, but, you know, it is worth thinking about, isn't it? That suddenly this is just out there. Just a thought.
I mean, obviously, I guess some of the business insiders that are supportive of the insurance industry, maybe they say, hey, now we got our candidate. If they're willing to do all these, you know, intricate deals to get him funded, if you will. Well, Catherine, what do you think of this for him?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people, I mean, those of us inside baseball people, you know, we don't like this. But I think a lot of people figure, well, isn't that what they all do? Don't they all get money from there?
Yeah, but this is a little more extreme. It's not like,
yeah.
I mean,
it's a little sneakier. That's the thing that I think is makes people troubled, is that he, I mean, it sounds like from reading the AJC piece that, you know, they were, I mean, I can't cast aspersions, but it sounds sneaky. You know, it's coming from Alabama, and I don't know. But
that's what money laundering is. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
Taking money and sending it through another source, so something that might not have been legal comes legal. I mean, this is the same kind of thing in that it had to go to another source so it would meet the fundraising law, not the actual law, but the fundraising law.
Well, it smacks of a payoff, don't it? I mean, let's face it, this guy regulates these people. And these are people giving him money, and they may be giving him more money than they're supposed to be giving him.
Right. Oh,
and it looked that way, you know, it don't look good.
Oh, no, I think this definitely hurts his chances, because he really didn't have a lot of room for error with his, you know, crowded primary field. And we're not even talking about the general yet. We're just talking about getting the nomination. I mean, I've been looking for reasons why that poll number has him leading is false. I mean, I just don't believe it. And maybe it was true, but I don't think it'll be true again. And, you know, Tom Jensen had told us he's going to do a poll. Well, I wonder if we're going to see some movement by the time his poll comes out, because if he does it this week, you think starting this week there'll be some residuals. Because, you know, the Republican convention was this week in Savannah. They seem to have conventions every time the, you know, turns around, but they're having another one.
They have conventions a lot, don't they?
They do. I mean, good for them. I mean, it's probably a lot of fun to be a Republican activist. They meet and they treat them to all these different little things to make sure that they, you know, get supportive of these candidacies. So I'm sure this is, you know, the room was abuzz about this. So it may have moved some allegiances. I mean, Peach Pundit, they're a good source to actually see that kind of thing. I didn't see a lot about it. But I mean, maybe we'll start seeing, you know, if there was any movement off of this. So it's something to watch.
Well, he's got another problem, too. A lot of this is being investigated by the Alabama Secretary of State's office. I don't imagine that office gives a hang about the Georgia governor's race.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're going to dig.
Yeah, because I guess if there's some way that, I guess her name's Ivy, Ivy, you know, she can look like an investigator on this, then maybe of corruption, maybe that helps her. I mean, obviously, I don't think she owes anything to John Oxendine, and they're both Republicans, but this is the kind of thing. If it's going to really hurt him, it's going to hurt him among Republicans. It's not even going to have to get to him versus the Democrats. Speaking of Alabama, there was a report on Left in Alabama, Cheryl's blog over there, about them looking to recruit another people in Alabama looking to recruit another candidate into the Democratic primary for governor. And my first thought on this was, okay, you've got sitting Congressman Artur Davis. Then you've got the Agriculture Commissioner, who's very popular over there, Ron Sparks. Is another candidate really needed? Catherine, how did that report strike you?
How many candidates do we need, you know?
Yeah, I mean, they've got two. I mean, Sue Bell Cobb is probably, I mean, she's a Supreme Court justice. I mean, obviously, she's probably brings us something a little different, both in her background and her occupational background. You know, but still, it's like, you know, crowd that primary up even more in a very tough state. It's a state, if you saw the presidential election, is a much tougher deal for Democrats than Georgia or North Carolina or Virginia.
And it just seems like I just would like to see these tough primaries not be so tough so that we can save our resources for the general elections.
It will be interesting to see what happens. I mean, maybe it's, and I was wondering, maybe it's just try to find a candidate that's more left-leaning. I really don't, I'd have to study, her opinions on cases to understand her political bent. I know that some people are unhappy with Artur Davis, that he's moved very much to the middle. But then, being African-American, maybe he feels he has to have a chance in a state like Alabama. And then Ron Sparks, agriculture policy, there's not so much a left-right bent to it. I know he's very popular with progressives in that they thought he might run for Senate, make that a real race because he does have popularity. So it's more like an electability potential popularity more so than a stand on issues popularity. Tim, your thoughts on all this?
Well, I read the blog story on it and checked out a couple of more sources. Apparently, there were a couple of heavyweights that were trying to recruit Lieutenant Governor Folsom, and he kept hee-hawing around on them and couldn't decide, and apparently they were not happy with that, so they just told him that they would recruit Sue Bell Cobb. So, we really don't have any idea if she's even interested in doing this. She's the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court. She just got reelected to her current term last year, which means she's got 3 more years to serve on this term. As you have mentioned, different from a lot of other states, for a Democrat right now, running for governor in Alabama is at best an iffy proposition. So, all things considered, if I were her, I wouldn't do it. There's my thoughts on it.
Yeah, and I'll tell everybody, if anybody asks me from Alabama, I'd say, why not? Why are you trying to recruit, Lieutenant Governor Jim Folsom into that race? Why not save him? Because you never know that. If you're going to win this race, why can't this race be won this year by Artur Davis or by Ron Sparks? Obviously,
right,
the racial component, then that Alabama, 1 out of every 4 white voters, sometimes some races, 1 out of every 5 white voters is Democratic, which makes it very, very tough. But
we learned the hard way in Georgia back in 2006 what happens when all of your heavyweights run in the same race. They lose, and then the bench is gone.
And then you have Jim Folsom as your bench.
Right.
Somebody could say, hey, Jim Folsom's a little older. Maybe Jim Folsom should have been the run this time, save Ron Sparks or Artur Davis, the younger candidates. But if Jim Folsom did want to run,
right,
I think if it posted this week on Blog for Democracy was that great flow chart. And if I'm not mistaken, one of the things on deciding whether you wanted to run or not was, do you want to run? Give you fire in your belly. If you don't. Or if he has stay lieutenant governor, because this isn't a situation where you're saying, oh, my bad back, I need to have back surgery, I can't raise money. If that sounds familiar, I guess you've listened to the show or followed the career of Casey Cagle. That's the kind of thing that you got to ask yourself on these situations.
Right.
Well, I guess that while we're doing governor's races in the South, let's go ahead and go to another one. Texas, some polls came out, and I guess if you like Rick Perry, there was a poll from you from Rasmussen Reports. But if you like Kay Bailey Hutchinson in the Republican primary, there was a poll for you that was actually paid for by the Rick Perry campaign. It's kind of bad when the poll you pay for gives you worse results than the free poll. Could have saved you money. Seriously, I know pollsters out there, calm down. I know that they ask other questions that are probably more valuable than just the horse race number. But this is just on the horse race number. But, Catherine, what'd you think of these two numbers?
Well, it's a ways away, and...
Yeah. Now they have an early primary in that state. I believe it's February, March. It's very early, so a little earlier than here.
Yeah.
But it's a little ways away.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's all going to be, you know, how Rick Perry does in the coming months. I mean, Kay Bailey Hutchison is kind of a known. I mean, people know Rick Perry too, but I'm sure it's going to depend on how the economy in Texas comes around, and you know how the jobs are, and all that kind of stuff, and how his leadership is in the last, you know, whatever year of his leadership. Don't you think?
Yeah, because they've only had like about a decade now, the guy, to decide on him.
It really is about, you know, how he did today when you go to the polls for most people.
I'll go ahead before we throw it to Tim. I do want to say, if this race is about the governor of Texas, I think right now in the lead, Kay Bailey Hutchison. But now if it's going to be who's the next El Presidente of the nation of Texas, I think those voters are more Rick Perry voters.
Yeah, you're right.
Tim?
Well, we know what Governor Perry has done at these tea parties, and we know why he did it, because we've been looking at all of these polls. All of a sudden, Scott Rasmussen comes out with a poll that shows Perry 4 points ahead, and everybody gets excited. But remember, we're talking about Scott Rasmussen here, folks. He polls likely voters, always. Well, when you poll likely voters 11 months before a primary, they tend to be erratic. Then his polls get very accurate close to elections, and the reason is it's easier to identify likely voters the closer you get to the actual vote. So you know what I'm going to say? This poll is an outlier. Discount it, because this poll does not get into line with the other polling.
Oh, yes.
Everybody with me there?
Oh, I know what you're saying. I mean, it's people are going to change their minds back and forth. Everybody's going to do something when it doesn't, you know, come up on the ballot for 8-10 months. Well, I believe go ahead, Tim.
I was just going to say, the other polling on the race has not been likely voters. It's just been registered.
Yes. So that does change, although I think it matters even more closer. Well, I think our next guest is on the line, Demetric Viggs. How you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
Yes. Well, Demetric, go ahead and tell us, give us a little bit of background. I think at the top of the show we introduced a little bit about you, but let everybody know your background.
Thank you, David. I'm a consultant right now doing some political consulting in Mississippi and Tennessee and Georgia. Worked for the Democratic National Committee for about 3 years, Mississippi Democratic Party, Democratic Party of Georgia. But right now I'm just kind of in between my next big campaign and just kind of working for a few candidates that I know that are running for some local municipal offices.
Yes, that's one of the reasons we wanted to have you on. We know you're a Mississippi native. Spend a lot of time there in Jackson.
Correct.
By the way, you're on here with Tim Shiflett and Catherine Smith as well on the Kudzu Vine.
Hey.
Good evening.
Yes, but Demetric, go ahead and this Jackson mayor's race, you had about a double-digit number of candidates running, and the election was this Tuesday, and even if it would have just been an election that fleshed itself out, it was intriguing, but then, of course, it had a little bit of more tragic intrigue as the day went on. Kind of tell us what's going on there in Jackson.
Yeah, no problem. I'm assuming everyone is aware our incumbent mayor Frank Melton, had kind of come into politics, probably the way he left out. I mean, he was not your average candidate. He said what he thought. He had a lot of support. He defeated a very popular two-term mayor, the first African-American mayor of the city of Jackson, Harvey Johnson, in 2005. But probably soon after taking office, he had gotten into some trouble, I guess, legally. He thought he was maybe police chief, maybe sheriff, but his crime-fighting tactics landed him in court several times, a lot of lawsuits. So, you know, I was kind of looking, I guess, a couple years ago that he would likely be reelected, but all of that kind of went out the way once, like I said, his legal suit started playing on, and then the federal government got involved. He'd had a run-in at the U.S. Capitol where he had flashed a police badge and brought a gun into the House of Representatives. So, I mean, it was, you know, he had all of that kind of stuff swirling around him. It looked about 2 months ago, that he was probably not going to make it out of this primary. He may have made it in the runoff, but it just didn't look like he had all the support he had coming into office 4 years ago with about 67% of the vote in the primary. So the primary was pretty crowded. The incumbent, well, the former mayor, Harvey Johnson, was in it. We had a state senator, tax collector, several other candidates. And, you know, he came in third place in that race. Going into election day, it looked like the incumbent mayor and the city councilman, Marshawn Chrysler, were going to come out pretty strong, and they did. And they, I think each of them had somewhere around 27-28% of the vote. Melton came in third, and so on. And so as the polls began to close, I remember getting a call that someone had said that the mayor was unresponsive. I think some folks had tried to go pick him up to take him to his campaign headquarters for the little celebration that, you know, the general have after the election. And, you know, they found him unresponsive, so they rushed him to the hospital. And, you know, I guess where he subsequently passed. But, you know, it just kind of – I know they interviewed the two winning candidates, well, at least the two candidates that have been in the runoff after it, and it was just kind of a shock, you know, because it was kind of like you mentioned, I think, earlier, it was a tragic end to a very storied career of a very unorthodox, to say the least, politician. And so, I mean, that's kind of where we are now with this runoff later part of the week, but all the focus, of course, will now be centered on remembering the mayor and his funeral and the state funeral lies ahead. So, I mean, it was a pretty shocking. No one could have predicted the outcome, but it did, you know, kind of end the way it did, and that's unfortunate. But I mean, it's been a tough week for a lot of people.
Yes. In the runoff, it's one of the closest ones I've ever seen. I believe. The former mayor, Harvey Johnson, was ahead almost all the night by a small percentage. I think actually at one point Frank Melton did lead Marshawn Chrysler, but Marshawn Chrysler just grew throughout the night. And I believe when all the votes were counted, he was, you know, tenths of percentage of points in the lead. Where did his votes come from that helped him gain throughout the night to then finally grab a very small lead heading to the runoff?
Yeah, no problem. I believe Marshawn was able to play a lot in the more affluent parts of the city, the northern part of Jackson. I think those familiar with Jackson, the area from I-55 going east, going into like the suburbs of Ridgeland and some other more affluent parts of the city. So I think Marshawn was able to appeal to that group because he had a lot of the big money people behind him, Leland Speed, who's the director of the Mississippi Development Authority, Billy Munger. Now, a lot of them are Republicans, but, you know, they do a lot of business in Jackson, a lot of money behind them. And so I think he was able to play a lot better in the more, I guess, affluent areas in the city. He got a lot of white vote. And so I think that made him a pretty attractive candidate. And I believe that's where, if we were to kind of extrapolate his votes out, that's where a lot of it would have come from. And I think Harvey Johnson just had, you know, he had that same core of support along with a lot of the people who, you know, maybe voted for Mayor Melton the first time but realized, you know, maybe we didn't have such a bad mayor the first and second time around. So, you know, I think between the two of them, they took most of that vote and then the rest, you know, your Melton hardline supporters, and then on through the rest of the field.
Well, the mind trick, I probably have 10 more questions or 5 more questions at least for you here, but I want to go ahead and share your knowledge with Tim and Catherine. So Tim has to have some questions and pass it to Catherine. If there's anything left when y'all get finished, I'll ask them.
Well, I'm fascinated by it. I don't really have any specific questions, but I'm sure Tim does, so I'll pass it to him.
Okay.
You know, they always say that a runoff is about three things: turnout. So which candidate might have a tougher time getting their supporters back to the polls, and why?
Right. Well, surprisingly, I believe I'd have to say that former Mayor Harvey Johnson may have a harder time. And I say that because, again, if you look at the support Marshawn Chrysler received, it's from areas that generally probably, you know, may not have to really work during the day, or, you know, he's just got his base of support, I think, is more prone to turn out in a runoff. And so I think if I had to bet, you know, I would bet that he would probably have the easier time getting his folks to come back out, and I would think that Mayor Johnson would probably have to work a little harder, because, again, a lot of the Frank Melton supporters will probably be folks that, you know, if I guess had to vote again, would likely vote for Mayor Johnson, but we'd have to kind of see that. But I would think Mayor Johnson would probably have a harder time in the runoff.
Okay, and tied in with that, of course, is the fact Mayor Melton is no longer on the scene with his sudden and tragic passing, but he did finish third. And so I was wondering, will his supporters set this one out, or will they vote and who for?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would really hope they wouldn't sit it out, but I just don't. Likely, I think that's very likely that they may. And quite honestly, I think they probably, you know, had things went differently, you know, had the mayor just lost and, you know, kind of gradually went on out, I think they probably would have sat out anyway. His supporters were fed up, angry, most of them inner city, poor, and they were kind of attracted to his crime fighting, you know, get the bureaucrats out type, you know, style of politics. And so they tended to be very loyal to him. So now if they, you know, I think if they were to go back out and vote, it would just be my guess that they would probably vote for Mayor Johnson. But, you know, if they sit out, I wouldn't be too surprised at that as well. You just have to kind of see. I think it all kind of falls. It's all going to fall this week, I believe. I think the runoff is at the end of the week. And then, of course, the funeral and everything, I believe, is tomorrow and Tuesday. So I'm just not real sure how they'll actually get involved.
Okay. Thank you, sir. David?
Yeah,
yes,
let
sir.
Me check that. That date, I believe, is May the 19th. I just happened to pull up Marshawn Chrysler's website on there, May the 19th. So it's actually it's a week from Tuesday. Still very close. I mean, you guys think that's a bam-bam, you know, two-week period, so there's a quick turnaround in getting this thing decided from so many candidates.
Right.
Also, John Horn, I believe, that's the state senator. I think he had a pretty, you know, decent amount, and his vote will have to come somewhere as well.
Right.
Tim Heck certainly took one of those questions with where do the supporters go of the other candidates, and it is hard to predict. The other question I had is, okay, the two top vote-getters, Marshawn Chrysler and Harvey Johnson, both African-Americans. But I was reading a story, and the story was, you know, by the just a very generic story by the Jackson paper there. But then the comments, you know how most newspapers now have where you can respond to stories. Well, in there was this really racial element, you know, to the story, particularly directed negatively at Marshawn Chrysler. And I look at his site, and I see his family. Everything seems to be very African-American about his life. Why do some that support Johnson or other candidates want to attack Marshawn Chrysler on the basis of race?
Yeah, no problem. That's a good question. It was believed real early in Marshawn's campaign, and I mentioned earlier that he received a lot of money from Leland Speed, Billy Munger, who are very rich and very much so white Republicans. So it was believed that Marshawn received a great deal of not only financial you know, but organizational support from rich white Republicans. And so I think that turned on, I know it turned off a lot in the local Democratic establishment in and around Jackson and Hinds County against Marshawn, who's a very popular, I think, two or three term city council member. And, you know, prior to this, I mean, he you never would hear anything like this about him. So I think that, if anything, if I had to pinpoint what, you know, what harbor those kind of attitudes are, you know, about him, I would have to say that it was the fact that he, you know, was believed it. And I believe he did take, you know, and get money from those folks. But, you know, in that area, you really can't even raise funds or take funds from Republicans. And I'm not going to say more so whites, but, I mean, that's the way it was equated. And so that's kind of how the, I guess, animosity in the black community is now, you know, coming out at him. But, you know, he raised a great deal of money in his campaign, and a lot of it come from the money pockets outside of Jackson. But, you know, for the most part, closer, more ideologically with Haley Barbour than Marshawn or any of the other black candidates in the race.
Yeah, I just have seen this play out in other races around the country. I know that there's a movie, Street Fight, with Cory Booker, who's now the mayor of Newark, New Jersey. This type of tactic was used against him when he first ran against Street James. And I think Tim and I have seen that documentary. I don't know if you have or Catherine has. Street.
I haven't.
Yeah, Street Fight. And there's much that dynamic. Also, Bobby Rush, when he ran for his, or he was trying to defend his congressional seat, he used that against the state senator that we now know as President Barack Obama, but he used that same kind of tactic. I just don't understand. This tactic seems to be, when it was first employed, it worked, but it seems to be this tactic doesn't work anymore. So do you think this will backfire in some way against the former mayor or play in the race anyway? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think it will because I think of all the candidates, it probably was Mayor Johnson, who probably, although I'm not real sure, but didn't employ those kind of tactics. But I think it only works if, you know, people are really following it. And Jackson, if it's like any other city in the country, you know, the citizens and folks there have a whole lot, you know, more other things to worry about other than who Marshawn is getting his money from. But you know, it did a lot, I know, to turn off the Democratic base, you know, maybe the executive committee or activists, but the average person just probably didn't care, you know, because it's just, it's not something that I wouldn't think folks would, you know, would equate to a vote. And, you know, it works, I guess. It just depends on how much money is behind it, what kind of effort it is that they put out to put that out there. But I think Marshawn is probably in better shape, and as he was all throughout the campaign, than any of the other candidates, because he had the money, he had the image, and he had the record. And so I think what'll be paramount in this runoff is that the candidate, that A, gets the message out even more than the other, and then B, goes after the, you know, 8 or 10 or 12,000 folks that didn't vote for either one of them. It's probably the candidate that will come out on top on the 19th.
Yes. Well, Demetric, we certainly enjoyed having you on talking about this race.
I appreciate it.
And keep us informed. If you're going to be working in Tennessee, Georgia, and maybe some in your native state of Mississippi, you may be able to bring us information on other races.
Well, I will. I do, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you all.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
No problem. Thank you. All right.
Thanks again. Demetric Biggs, he worked a long time, really understands Mississippi politics so well, and was a quick study in Georgia politics when he came out here and worked some during the 2008 cycle. But very informative on that race, which, you know, I'm going to be honest, didn't start out as maybe the most interesting race, city, you know, municipal race this year. But I think when all is said and done, it may be one of the most intriguing to follow, particularly, and like I said, in some tragic ways, too.
Let me throw this in. Not to be bragging, but have you noticed that candidates that we have had on this show tend to do very well on election night? I'm just saying.
Well, it probably shows that they want to interact with people and accept new forms of media and be willing to take chances now. So that's it is interesting. I mean, that, you know, he did so well, and
it's the Paul Brown syndrome, David. I think it's a genuine syndrome right here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm telling you.
Yeah, and Mr. No Inoculations himself with Phil Gingrey. I don't fully understand that issue. We might cover that next week. But going ahead and still moving around the South, Jim Bunning, at the start of the week, there was a big Kentucky dinner, a big political event in Louisville, the Lincoln Day dinner, that supports the Republican Party of Kentucky. People had expected that Jim Bunning would announce his retirement and that he was supporting Trey Grayson, and last night he did not do that. He said, "I am running again." Catherine, were you a little shocked by that?
I was shocked by that. He's like the Energizer Bunny. He just won't give up.
No one controls me in this.
Yeah.
No one controls me.
I am nobody's puppet.
Yeah. It's that stuff. You know, but it's that kind of thing. I mean, he's their biggest headache because, of course, they gave away one of their other headaches, Arlen Specter, to us. I've seen that some people in the Democratic caucus are now wanting to re-gift that one. but, yeah, I mean, he's their biggest headache. I mean, they know he's in trouble in a state that's really, you know, trending a little more Republican, one of the few places that may be doing that. And they're, you know, going to lose this seat if he continues these shenanigans. So it was, you know, pretty shocking there. Tim, your thoughts on it?
Well, you know, I had wanted to dismiss Senator Bunning with the assertion that he was just simply crazy. But you know what? This is something pretty base, David. He just does not like Mitch McConnell.
Yeah.
And Mitch McConnell really does not like him. And in my heart of hearts, I believe now he did what he did last night just to get a dig at McConnell. I'll show you, buddy. I believe that's what every bit of this is about now.
Yeah, I wonder if there's anybody in the Republican Senate caucus, you know, be it John McCain, be it John Cornyn. I mean, I know he's the head of the NRCC. McCain was their standard bearer in the party. Anybody that he really respects, and they could go to him and say, "Look, you know, you're a baseball pitcher. Well, sometimes your manager had to come out to the mound, and they said to say, 'Give me the ball. I'm putting in somebody else. You're done. It's time.'" I mean, you know. But I mean, of course, I wouldn't listen. Everybody's like, "Well, say baseball, and you're not a manager." But I mean, it's just. They need to do that for the good of their own party. I mean, you know, of course, I have a rooting interest for them not to do that, but you just think they'd have to figure out some way to do it. And obviously, McConnell is not the man for the job.
Hatred is a strong emotion, David, and it's not logical. And this man's behavior is not logical. And I really think now it is based on pure and unadulterated hatred, and it's going to cost them that Senate seat, too.
Oh, yes. Well, I'm not sure we can get to every topic, but we're going to go a little different, not just a pure political, you know, Democrats and Republicans, who's going to win this, who's going to win that. It was interesting. The topic of torture really got, to me, an interesting player inserted. You know, for a while, Keith Olbermann, shows like that on MSNBC, have been talking a lot about torture and, you know, these things need to be prosecuted. Everybody said, oh, you know, it's a left-wing blog issue, this, that, and the other. Well, the Southern Baptist Convention, led by Richard Land, he actually signed his name on it, who's, you know, very much a leader in the conservative movement, came out this week and said, you know, America cannot be involved in torture. I think this really changes the political dynamics of this thing. Catherine, what's your thought on this?
I was really surprised by it, that they, you know, were so outspoken against it. I think it's good. What it may do, though, is just take it off the front page, because if enough conservatives support the Southern Baptist Convention and their lack of support for the stuff, then it's no longer a divisive issue.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I think Barack Obama, and rightfully so, has said, you know, we don't want anything to rip our country apart, But then if religious groups, I'm sorry, conservative groups like the Southern Baptist Convention are saying, look, this is just not appropriate. This is not an America that we want to see with liberty. It really changes the dynamics. If there's certain individuals in the Bush administration that were very, very heinous in approving certain parts, they really don't have a lot of political refuge with folks on the right, you know, saying, you know,
right.
No way. Tim,
mm-hmm.
Your thoughts?
Well, that's why it was so stunning to me. I'm sitting here looking at a rundown of their program at their national meeting, which is coming up in Louisville next month, as a matter of fact. Their two chief speakers are Chuck Colson and Mike Huckabee. Last year, their chief speaker was Condoleezza Rice. The year before that, it was President Bush. The year before that, it was Dan Quayle. Now, we are talking about an organization that invites people like this to speak, and for them to come out with something like this is absolutely earth-shattering and really back-breaking. I mean, how do the supporters of this torture or whatever now justify it when a group like that is not in their corner anymore? And they are a powerful group. Don't let nobody kid you. The Southern Baptist Convention is a very powerful organization down here.
Yeah, and I think within the Republican primary electorate, they're even more powerful. So there's
yep.
not going to be as much defense then of these folks in some corners. Well, I guess the last topic we're going to get to, it seems like it deserves well more than just 3 minutes, but we just had a full show. Early in the process, when David Souter retired, Leah Sears, Chief Justice of the Georgia Supreme Court, was mentioned as a possible candidate. I have not seen her come off of shortlist, but I have not been following the shortlist for the picking. What is y'all's thoughts on what's going to happen here? Tim?
Well, they still keep saying that the favorite is a lady from California by the name of Kathleen Sullivan, who is openly lesbian, I understand. But Leah Sears, at first I thought she was just one of those names that you see on lists like this. No, I think she really is on the short list. Now, not only that, she retires in June. Souter retires in June. She turned down a gig. Where was it at? The University of Maryland?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, somewhere.
Somewhere like that. Saying she wanted to pursue other opportunities. Well, what I think she wants the job. Maybe. What do you think, Catherine?
Yeah. Well, I think as far as the list, like they're all being very, very hush about, you know, what the short list is. There has been a lot of talk about Kathleen Sullivan, a lot of talk about Sonia Sotomayor, and of course Leah Sears has been on that list as well. I don't know if you all saw the Washington Post piece today that it's an unusual piece. There's a link to it from Political Insider, I think, talking about how it turns out Leah Sears and Clarence Thomas are good friends. They've known each other for a long time. They both grew up in around near coastal Georgia, and apparently Thomas had reached out to her when she was brought into the Supreme Court of Georgia, and so they go back a ways, and so now she's getting some criticism from the left or from the progressive, you know, caucus, or not specifically, but you know, there's just some hoo-ha about how can she be friends with him and all that kind of stuff.
Well, but that's on a personal level.
I know, it's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous thing.
You know, she dissented when they upheld the sodomy law and called the decision pathetic and disgraceful.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, therefore, that's a very progressive decision.
I mean,
I think she's a fine progressive. I don't think, and obviously the Georgia Republicans would laugh at her being a big ally of Clarence Thomas.
Right, exactly. But that's one of the things that's getting some, you know, ink right now.
Yes, one thing.
But I agree with you, Tim. I think it's something that I would love to have her on the court. She's very young. She could serve for a long time. She has, you know, proven her legal prowess over the years. She was the first African-American Chief Justice of any state Supreme Court in the country, or first African-American woman, I guess. But, and she, I think she would be great. I would love to see her. But I think that there's a list of very talented people. There's a lot of very talented jurists out there who could serve on the court very well. So I'm sure that they have a lot of, you know, they're taking a look at a lot of different people. So,
well, I mean, one place that, you know, Obama's cabinet is not diverse, and we've discussed this, is the fact that he has no Southerners. Now, obviously, this is not a cabinet post, but still, this would give some Southern diversity to his administration, if you will.
And, David, I want you to get the last question of the night, and here it is. Is the nominee going to be a woman?
Well, if you look at ABC's potential list on their news site, I think I've seen six faces. I need to go to page 3. All of them are female. I did watch Chris Matthews make that. Oh, finally, the governor of Massachusetts, the only male on their short list. Well, one
Neville
of them. You know, so, I mean, the whole pool is female, but then you do have another need. They talked about being possibly, you know, naming Hispanic, although I think, I have a funny feeling that Barack Obama is going to make more than one appointment. If I had to guess an over-under, if he serves two terms, it'd be no less than three on a number of appointments.
Possibly, yeah.
Because I think you're going to have some people that may have been appointed by Carter in particular, possibly Clinton, that say, hey, I want to retire with the Democrats in office. Even some of the Republicans, like Souter, that were are Republican appointees, they're, you know, Souter probably got to the point where he wanted to wait for a Democrat.
Yeah, I think he did.
Yeah, and so, I mean,
well, he might not have been wanting to wait for a Democrat. He just wanted to wait till Bush was out of there.
Yeah, and so, therefore, you know, you may have some other folks to retire, and therefore he gets to appoint more. So if he can make and say, hey, I want to put this one in now, I put this person in later, I can still, you know, do the Hispanic and do another female, things like that. So, it's going to be interesting to see. We went a little over tonight, but I think that was a good topic to go over on. Next week, we should have some interesting things. I think we're going to talk to the guys from Tondi's Tavern. John Flack, we welcome him back to Tondi's Tavern. But, you know, we're going to maybe talk and find out what's going on over there. Also, Catherine, kudos on all the new stuff on Blog for Democracy. Give our thanks and congratulations, whatever is appropriate, to Melanie Goo on her work there.
Well, we're working on it. We're going to have some new authors coming out and some additional sub-blogs. So.
Yeah, we'll probably have to talk some more about that, too. And I'm sure there's other things going on. I have another guest I'm trying to line up. But for all you mothers out there, have a good, you know, 4 more hours of Mother's Day.
Thank you, guys.
Good night.
Good night.